Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's December 1st. We got two more lectures today, and then on Monday, and then Wednesday there's no class because that's the beginning of finals week. But we do have a final in here, and that is a week from today. Let's see, am I right on that? No, I'm not right on that. Let's see. Today's the 1st. Oh, so a week from today we have one more lecture. And then a week from that Monday is the final. So December 13th at 10:30 right here. So make sure you have your picture ID and a good eraser and a pencil ready to go. So on that last test, even though you have 2 hours, it's just a regular test. So it's from 10:30 to 12:30. You've got chapters 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. Okay? So that should just about do it. One of the labs is even done with everything already. That was the morning lab. Are there any questions? Yeah? Just on Monday. Because finals start, I think, on Tuesday or Wednesday. I'm not sure of next week. But anyway, by the time December 8th rolls around, that is a finals day. So there's no lecture. I believe I could have a lecture on that day if I wanted to, but we're not going to meet. Okay, so December 8th, we do not meet. All right, and then in Blackboard, I'll put my office hours online in case you want to see me during that week, but I haven't figured out my office hours schedule for finals week. It changes a little bit, but probably not too much. Okay, so any other questions at all? No? All right, so we're going to start talking about the diversification system. Okay, but before we get there, all right, I do want to ask you, what is the function of the reproductive system? I didn't go over this with everybody in lab, so I thought maybe I'd just go over it really quick during lecture. Who's got an idea what the reproductive system is for? What's it all about? A lot of people are saying, reproduction, but There's something different about the way that we reproduce compared to how many other organisms reproduce. And I should have loaded up a little slide right here. Next time I'll show you. All right, a hydra, which is just a little polyp. It's got a stem and a bunch of tentacles, and it feeds itself by stinging little crustaceans and things, and the tentacles bring it to the mouth, and it feeds off those things. Well, anyway, when it's time for something like that to reproduce, a little hydra just buds from the side, and when that little hydra that's budding from the side of the, well, we'll call it the mother animal, when it gets big enough, it just breaks away, falls to the ground, and it starts to grow, and it's a new independent organism. All right, but what is that new independent organism like compared to the mother? Or maybe we could call it the father. I'm not sure it really even has a sex, right? What is it like compared to the mother-father animal? Identical. They're identical, yeah. They're just a clone of the parent. That's a good way of saying it. The parent animal, right? So they're just a clone. But if you were to look around the room right here, the reason that we have a reproductive system, I think, is as plain as the nose on your face, which is what? If you look around the room, do you see another nose like yours around anywhere in the room? No. Right, so everybody in here is new and unique, right? New and unique. That's really the purpose of our reproductive system, not just to make another individual, but to make that individual new and unique. So even if you were to go outside and look around all over campus, you could never find another you. Or if you went to a big stadium like the Colosseum and it got filled up with 100,000 people and you searched everybody in the Colosseum, would you find another you? No, as a matter of fact, you wouldn't. Okay? So, I have a question. How many sexes are there?
Two.
And is that enough? Yes, enough for what? For reproduction? Well, yeah, but that's not really the bump. That's really not the purpose of the reproductive system. New and unique. That's right. It's got to produce something new and unique. And does it function well that way? Because if you look around, you don't see thousands of people that are exactly the same. Maybe with science, technology, you know, one day that might happen. But if it's just a natural process, that never happens, right? So two sexes are plenty to make everybody new and unique. Now, here's another question. So your parents made you at one point in time, okay, and if they're still alive, could they make another you? Okay, some people are saying no, not exactly. But you know what? If they made you at one time, what's preventing that from happening again? There's really nothing that's stopping that from happening. So they could produce another exact copy of you, right? It wouldn't be exactly the same person because it would be born at different times. You'd have different experiences and things like that. So you'd be two different people, but genetically you would be like identical twins, okay? Just separated maybe 10 years apart or 20 years apart. So it certainly is possible, but because of the structure and the way that our reproductive system works, the odds of that happening are so astronomically small that it will probably never, ever happen as long as the universe continues, right? Which is billions and billions and billions of years, right? So that's really the importance of our reproductive system. That kind of explains why it is so complicated, why some of us have a vagina, right? Some of us a scrotum. Some of us have progesterone. Some have testosterone. Right, so it's all complicated so that nature has ensured that we are all different. And why is that a really good thing? Why is that a good thing that we're all different? And we call that diversity. The reason why diversity is important is for, and I mentioned this when we first started studying bones, okay, if there's a cold going around right now, maybe a flu, but kind of a bad cold, some people are staying home from work, right? And when that virus is going around, do we all come down with a cold? We all don't come down with it. Some of us are more susceptible than others, right? So that diversity protects the population from a single malady just wiping us all off the face of the planet. So a virus like a cold is not very significant, but there are some very dangerous processes that possibly could kill everybody if we all were identical. Right, and then that would be the end of the human race. So diversity is really important. Now, when we started talking about bones, I mentioned that there's one process that was pretty strange because it will affect everybody if we're lucky enough to live old enough. And that was osteoporosis. And I said, that's really a strange disease because now maybe you could say why it's such a strange disease. Why is that such a strange disease? Because our reproductive system makes us all different. Right, so because there's diversity in our population. But that's one disease that we all have to face if we live old enough. Of course, if you have bigger, stronger bones, you're less susceptible to it, but everybody as we get older will lose bone mass, okay? Unless you diet and exercise ahead of time, that can help protect you from that. All right, we get to another structure, okay, in this particular chapter where, again, that same strange kind of circumstance happens. It doesn't happen to women because they don't have this particular organ, but men have this organ, and if all men reach a certain age, they're going to have problems with this particular organ, and that is really strange. Why is that strange? Because everybody's different, because we're a diverse population. And why are we a diverse population? Because we reproduce how? Sexually. Right, we reproduce by sexual reproduction, so that means that everybody is different. Right, we just don't bud little babies from our torso, and the little baby just doesn't break off and start running around. Okay, and you might think of other good reasons why that doesn't happen, but one important reason is that we're a diverse population. All right, so one last thing before we start talking about the reproductive system, I just want to, and people are becoming aware of this more and more and more and more. And that is the baby safe laws that started in Texas, right? And then a number of years ago were transferred over here to California. And does anybody know what a baby safe law is? Baby safe law. Not too many people raising your hands right here. But it's just a law that says that if you give birth to a baby and you don't want that baby, or maybe you do want it but you can't take care of it and you're really concerned about how it's going to be brought up, you can deliver it to a police station or a fire station or emergency room, right? As long as it's within a certain period of time, every county is a little bit different, but usually it's about 48 hours. Some counties are maybe even as long as a week. You can surrender that baby to adoption and you'll have no legal or financial obligations or legal recourses placed against you. And does anybody know why that law was instituted? That's just to protect the lives of newborns, so that under really strange circumstances, if a new mother is really stressed out, right, sometimes the mother would actually kill the baby. Okay, so you don't have to worry about any kind of repercussions if you surrender a baby to a fire station or emergency room or even a police station. So I wouldn't expect that anybody in here would go through that kind of trouble, but, you know, it's good to pass that information around to make sure that everybody knows, right? Don't keep it a secret. So here on your lab list is a website that people can go to and get the latest and greatest news on the baby safe laws in LA County. But what county are we in? Orange County. All right, so that's close, but that's a place for you to start. Okay. All right, so the male reproductive system, let's start talking about that. The primary reproductive structure in the male is testes right here. All right, and a general name for testes is a gonad. All right, and as a matter of fact, females have a primary reproductive structure that is a gonad, but it's not a testes. What is that? That would be an ovary, right? And so the job of this testes right here is to produce gametes. We'll talk about what a gamete is. That's number one. And then number two is to produce sex cells. And so I'll draw on the board some things about that. Okay, so the other thing is that primary reproductive structure, a gonad, whether it's a testes or an ovary, also produces sex steroids. Like in the male, it's going to be testosterone, and in the female, it's going to be estrogen, which is kind of the female analog to testosterone, and a second hormone called progesterone. So females produce both estrogen and testosterone. All right, so here we have the testes down in the scrotum. It's not in the pelvic cavity, and it's producing sperm. Okay, and that sperm can, during ejaculation, move to the outside world by moving from the epididymis, which is this tube that kind of coils around the outside of the testes right here. Then it moves into a tube that takes it into the pelvic cavity, and that's what we call the vas deferens, or sometimes the ductus deferens. Right, and so this happens during ejaculation. Then it goes up over the top superior border of the bladder, and on the posterior part of the bladder, it curves back inferiorly, passes through the seminal vesicles right here, so that's an important gland, because the material moving through the vas deferens here pretty much is just sperm, right? And the sperm needs nutrients, and it needs a special environment to maintain motility, because remember, a sperm has a flagellum, which is moving around all the time, so it's propelling that sperm cell. So there are nutrients in the ejaculate that come from the seminal vesicles right here. So seminal vesicles add volume to the ejaculate. And then the vas deferens becomes the ejaculatory duct as it passes through the prostate gland. And the prostate gland also adds volume to the ejaculate. Right? And then at this point right here, the ejaculatory duct combines with the urethra in the male. That never happens in the female, but that happens in the male. So what the heck is the big job of the urethra? It's a connection between the urinary bladder and the outside world, so that's a way that people can void the urinary bladder right here. All right, so at this point in time, the urethra is doing the job of the urinary system as well as the reproductive system. And we have three different divisions of the urethra. The part that goes through the prostate gland is what we call the prostatic urethra. And the part that goes through the urogenital diaphragm right here, which is the floor of the perineum, including some muscles, we call that the membranous urethra. And then this part of the urethra that goes through the penis, of course, you could call the penile urethra. But maybe a little bit more specific name is named after the exact erectile tissue that it's passing through in the penis, and this is the corpus spongiosum. So it kind of looks like a sponge. There are a lot of sinuses right here that can fill up with blood, and it becomes very turgid, which means then that this is erectile tissue that can produce an erection in a penis. right, when the penis fills up with blood. All right, so the corpus spongiosum is really on the ventral side of the penis. We see some other erectile tissue in the penis, and this is the corpus cavernosum, and this is on the dorsal side or posterior side of the penis, right here. All right, so sometimes we call the penile urethra the spongy urethra as a result. Another part of the corpus spongiosum is the glans penis right here. All right, it's that part of the corpus cavernosum. All right, so that's a pretty good overview of some structures. Yeah. Spermatic cord includes a number of structures. I think on the next slide I have a pretty good picture of it. One of the structures that makes the spermatic cord is the vas deferens. So the spermatic cord is the connection between the pelvic cavity and the testes, which is down in the scrotum. Okay, so the spermatic cord includes the vas deferens, a muscle called the cremaster muscle, the testicular nerve, and then testicular artery and testicular vein. So all of those things, and then a couple sheaths of connective tissues. So that's part of the spermatic cord. So it goes between the pelvic cavity and the scrotum right here. Okay, the scrotum also has a muscle around it. Okay, it's not around the spermatic cord, and that's the Darthos muscle. All right, and we should probably talk about why the testes has descended down into the scrotum right here. Because the process of producing sperm cannot occur at normal body temperature, at 98.7 or 6 degrees. It's got to be colder than that. And so evolution has placed the testes in the scrotum so that it can be at a lower temperature. And we're going to look at the blood supply to the testes to see how it's maintained at a cooler than body temperature. So if there was a male that refused to get out of the hot tub, right, like a jacuzzi or something, spend his whole life in the jacuzzi, he would be sterile as a result of that, right, because that temperature would inhibit the normal spermatogenesis. And even some males have a low sperm count. If they have a tendency to wear really tight-fitting jeans, right, that forces the testes up against the body wall so that it's warm all the time, they can experience infertility as a result of that. Say that again? Yeah, the little skinny jeans. Don't wear the little skinny jeans if you're a guy. All right, so that is one view. Oh, let's take a look. There's a gland that I didn't mention, and that is the bulbourethral gland right here. So we have bulbourethral, prostate, and seminal vesicles. There may be some other minor glands. Okay, but the bulbourethral gland also adds a volume to the ejaculate, but all of these glands, when they add something to the sperm, it's either going to be agents that neutralize the acidic environment of the male urethra as well as the female vagina, because that will inactivate sperm, and the bulbourethral gland secretes mucus, which is a lubricant, but mucus is also part protein, so it acts like a buffer to neutralize the acid in the reproductive tract. Some other agents that are secreted by the seminal vesicles and prostate would be things that activate sperm, all right, so that the flagella start working. Also sperm nutrients, so they don't run out of energy. There are coagulation agents that are added to sperm, so when sperm enters the vagina, it just doesn't run right out, right? So that maintains sperm in the vagina, so that enhances fertilization. And there are also some agents that, prostaglandins, for instance, that cause smooth muscle to contract. For instance, like contraction of the smooth muscle within the vagina. All right, so those are all things that are secreted by these various glands that we see. All right. Okay, so here's a little bit different view. So we see the penis right here. Now, what view of the penis are we looking at? This is the ventral side. Okay, so here's the ventral side, and if we go back, where's the ventral side? Here's the ventral side that contains the corpus spongiosum. Here's the dorsal side, right? That's the corpus cavernosum. All right, can you picture that pretty well? Okay, and then we see the scrotum right here, and do we have the Darthos muscle? Oh, we don't have it really labeled. Oh, yeah, here it is. Okay, right in here. And here is the Cre master muscle, which is a part of the spermatic cord. So here is the connection between the pelvic cavity and the scrotum. All right, so one of the most external layers is the Cre master muscle. We also see this blue mesh or network right here. That's a testicular vein. And deep inside here, this red tube is the testicular artery, and we can see the testicular vein as well. And here is the vas deferens that also makes up the spermatic cord. So those are the structures that make up the spermatic cord. All right, so we have in the testicular artery blood entering the testes, and as it's leaving the pelvic cavity, what's the temperature of that testicular artery or the blood in the testicular artery? Yeah, it's at body temperature, normal body temperature, like 98.6, right, 98.7, something like that. And that is too hot to promote spermatogenesis within the testes right here. So surrounding the testicular artery is this plexus. We call that the pampiniform plexus. It's a venous plexus of blood returning from the scrotum back to the pelvic cavity. And the temperature of this blood, right, is going to be influenced by just the ambient temperature, which is pretty much usually cooler. So the blood in this pampiniform plexus then absorbs heat from the testicular artery, cooling that blood down so that by the time it gets to the testes right here, it's cold and spermatogenesis can take place. So the arrangement of the testicular artery and this pampiniform venous plexus is just a special heat exchange mechanism. It acts kind of like the radiator on your car. Right, so spermatogenesis takes place at the proper temperature. Okay. Any questions on that so far? Let's look at some ducts. So here we have the testes, so we're zooming in. We can see the pampiniform plexus and the testicular nerve, testicular artery right here. So here is the testes, and it has a couple tunics on it. All right, so this one right here is the tunica albuginea, and that's kind of a white tunic, and it invaginates deep inside the testes, forming different lobes inside the testes. And within a lobe, there are coiled tubes that we call the seminiferous tubules. And the seminiferous tubules are the places where spermatogenesis takes place. So sperm are being made in these areas right here. Okay. There are tissues that are outside the seminiferous tubules. We call those the interstitial spaces. They contain other kinds of cells that actually produce testosterone. So the tubules themselves produce sperm, but the interstitial spaces are responsible for producing the male sex steroid. All right, so then when sperm are made, they move from the seminiferous tubule into the straight tubule and then into the Reedy's testis and then into a little efferent ductule right here, entering the epididymis where they stay until ejaculation takes place. But as a sperm enters the epididymis, it's not mature. It's not functioning. It doesn't have a functional flagellum. And so sperms stay a certain period of time in the epididymis, all right, until ejaculation takes place. Right, and then they move through the vas deferens after they're mature. So here we have the tail of the epididymis. Here is the head of the epididymis. It kind of almost reminds me of like the pancreas a little bit in that regard. Okay, so here's a nice cross-section of the seminiferous tubules. And maybe I can see some small sperm that are starting to develop over here. Right, and we have some Sertoli cells that support spermatogenesis. Sometimes they're called sustentacular cells or sustentocyte, right? But most people just call them Sertoli cells. And then we also have germ cells, which are the precursor to sperm cells. And those germ cells can produce sperm throughout the whole lifespan of the male. Okay, so males typically don't become infertile as they grow older, though the sperm count usually does decrease. These interstitial cells right here, sometimes they're called cells of Leydig, And these are the cells that actually produce testosterone. And you can see that they are what? They are outside the seminiferous tubule. And the germ cells and the Sertoli cells inside the seminiferous tubules are dependent on testosterone from the cells of Leydig that are outside the seminiferous tubule. All right, so here's a little bit different view. So here's like a coronal view of the male reproductive system. So we have testes, right, epididymis, and then the vas deferens, sometimes it's called the ductus deferens. Coming back over the posterior side of the bladder, we see the seminal vesicles, and then the ejaculatory duct entering into the prostate gland. All right, and then moving through the urogenital diaphragm, we see the bulbourethral glands, and now we can actually see the full extent of the erectile tissue in the penis. All right, so in the ventral side, which we can only just barely get a little glimpse of, is the corpus spongiosum. All right, there's only one corpus spongiosum, and that's what the urethra moves through. All right, the corpus spongiosum also makes the glands penis right here. Right, but now we can see the other erectile tissue very nicely. This is these right here, both right and left. These are the corpora cavernosa. So corpora cavernosa is plural. Corpus cavernosum is singular. All right, so when the penis is erect, that is when these sinuses here fill with blood, and when the sinuses drain blood back to the circulation, that's when erection disappears. And it's a venous type of blood. Okay, so seminal vesicles form about 60% of the semen volume. It contains sperm nutrients, specifically like fructose. It has prostaglandins that stimulate uterine contractility and vaginal contractility, sperm motility agents, also an immunosuppressant, right? Because once the sperm are in the female, we don't want an immune response for the female to automatically target and kill those sperm, right? Coagulants that form that plug, and there's also a pigment in the volume from the seminal vesicle, and nobody really knows what the function of that pigment is, but it can be easily visualized under ultraviolet light. Okay, the prostate gland forms only about 30% of the semen volume. It contains a neutralizing solution, right? Motility agents, coagulants, right? And then a delayed liquefying agents, then that will time release sperm from the coagulant within the vagina. And then I talked about the bulbourethral gland already. Just basically it secretes mucus, but there's a very small amount, only about 5%. Okay, let's see if there's anything else I want to say about male reproductive system. No, but here's a nice picture that shows the two corpora cavernosa and the corpus spongiosum ventrally. Okay, so I want to draw some things on the board. So let's look at the human life cycle for just a little bit. All right, so here we have a cell in a gonad, and this one we're going to call a germ cell. And it has the same number of chromosomes as all of the majority of cells in your body. Does anybody know how many chromosomes make up the human cell? Yeah, there's 46. So there's 46 chromosomes in here, but it's actually with a special arrangement of them. There's actually two sets, and you should probably realize right away what that is for. Where do you get these two sets of chromosomes from? one from your mom and one from your dad. All right, so there's actually two sets. So here is one set over here, 1, 2, all the way down to number 23 over here. And then there's another set, 1, 2, down to 23 over here. So the number 1 chromosomes are basically the same size. They carry information for the same kinds of processes or structures in your body. And number 2 chromosomes are very similar. And then, of course, number 1 is a lot different than number 2. So it's easy, actually, to see them and separate them out by their size and their shape. So one set, okay, we call these the maternal chromosomes. And this set over here we call the paternal chromosomes, right? Or you could call them the papa chromosomes if you wanted to. Right? So here we have a germ cell with two sets. The job of the germ cell is to actually produce a gamete. So here is a gamete, and let's just say that this is a male. So what is this male gamete going to look like? Okay, it's going to look like a sperm because it has a flagellum, which means what's the function of this flagellum right here? Motility, so this sperm can swim around. Now, it doesn't have 46 chromosomes. It has only 23 chromosomes in there. But not 23 chromosomes all from mom, but that's a possibility, right? That would be a very rare circumstance, right? It's a mixture of maternal and paternal chromosomes, and every sperm is going to have a different arrangement, a different mixture of maternal and paternal chromosomes, and that's one reason why everybody is different, because every time a sperm is produced, it has a different arrangement of chromosomes, maternal and paternal chromosomes. All right, so this thing right here, if it only has 23 chromosomes, this is what we call a gamete. Okay, so one particular question might be, how many chromosomes does a gamete have? You would say 23 in the human, but in general, in the animal kingdom, it would be half the normal number. Right? And so we would say then that it is haploid if it has half the number of chromosomes. And since this germ cell has two complete sets, we call that diploid. So there's a specific process that will take a germ cell and produce a gamete, or take a diploid cell and make a haploid cell out of it. And you should know the name of that process. All right, and you should also contrast it with a different process where, all right, if we have this process where you have 46 chromosomes splitting up into two cells that are identical with both with 46 chromosomes. That's a different kind of process. So let's make sure that you can visualize that. So you've studied this process right here. What is that called? That is mitosis. So here's the parent cell. Here are the two daughter cells. What's the difference between these two daughter cells? Basically nothing. They're just clones of each other, right? They're the same. They came from the same organism. So this is mitosis, all right? And just to review, what's the purpose of mitosis? For two basic reasons. You could say reproduction, but that mitosis really means reproduction, right? Mitosis is, since these cells are the same, right, it's what? Asexual reproduction, because those cells are exactly the same. So mitosis takes place for two reasons. One is growth, okay, and the second is replacement of what? Of old or damaged or dead cells. What's one tissue in your body that gets replaced very frequently? Yeah, red blood cells and your skin. There's all kinds. Bones every 5 years. The lining of your digestive tract, most places every 5 days. Okay, so your red blood cells every 120 days, but you have millions of red blood cells, you know, that die every second because you have so many of them. All right, so that's mitosis, produces clones through asexual reproduction, but we're talking about a different kind of reproductive process here. What kind of reproduction are we talking about? Sexual reproduction. Okay, and what's the purpose of sexual reproduction? Produce something new and unique, right? A different combination of genes. Alright, so this process of going from a diploid cell to a haploid, or from a germ cell to a gamete, that's not mitosis. right? Because we're going from 46 to 23 chromosomes. We should know the name of that process. What's that called? And it starts with an M. M-E-I-O-S-I-S. Meiosis. So meiosis is a nuclear reduction. So the number of chromosomes are reduced when gametes are produced. So here we have a sperm. All right. Well, that's kind of a lonely sperm. So let's take another individual, all right, with 46 chromosomes. That's going to be, oh, what kind of cell is this if it's going to produce a sex cell? This is a germ cell. This is just a germ cell. Okay, so another germ cell over here. And it's going to produce another gamete with 23 chromosomes. And this particular cell is not motile. It can't swim around. All right, and this is coming from a female, so this is an egg or an oocyte. What's an oocyte? That's an egg. Okay. But what else is it? It's a gamete. And what can you tell me about gametes? What's the chromosome number? 23, which means that it has half the normal number. It is haploid. All right, so germ cells, remember, are diploid. All gametes are haploid. All right, so here we got another process. The sperm bumps into this egg, okay, like this. And now we have a single cell with, guess how many chromosomes? 46, 23 papa chromosomes or paternal chromosomes and 23 maternal chromosomes, right? So here we have a new cell back to 46 chromosomes. And now you can see that the genetic makeup of this particular cell is what? Part from the father and part from the mother, so it's a new and unique combination of genes. Right? And you should know the name of this cell right here. And anybody know what the name of this cell is right here? This is a zygote. All right, so that's a zygote, just a single cell. And we were all zygotes at one particular time. Okay, but that's not a very interesting form of life. Why? Because you can't come to anatomy class and take notes and do well on practicums and things like that if you're just a single cell, right? So this zygote then transforms itself into, okay, this structure right here. Okay, so that's you. How does an organism go from a zygote to a complete adult like that? Okay, what are the number of chromosomes in most of these cells right here? 46. So if you go from 46 to 46, what is that process called? That's mitosis. One of the functions of mitosis is what? Is growth. Okay. All right, so I do want you to know something about the human life cycle. And of course, when you get to this stage, what can happen? This whole thing can happen over and over again. Right, so that's the human life cycle. Okay, well, I think we're going to get started with the female reproductive system. Okay. Unless someone has a question about the male reproductive system. So far, so good. Okay. So the primary reproductive structure in the female is the ovary. All right, so that's where gametes are produced. So an ovary is a gonad, just like a testes, but it's quite a bit different. Doesn't produce sperm. It produces eggs or oocytes. And it doesn't secrete testosterone. It secretes a couple other hormones called estrogen and progesterone. All right, so it's a little bit different. Okay, so when it produces a gamete, okay, it's a little bit different than in the male because the production of immature egg cells is a fetal process that happens before a female is born. All right, and a female can't produce gametes through their whole life cycle. You only produce as many before you're born, and once you're born, that process stops. All right, so somebody might feel a little left out in the process of procreation compared to males because they can produce gametes their whole life cycle, but all right, the number of gametes that is produced is in the millions before you're born, all right, if you're a female. So that's really not such a big deal, because I have never met a woman yet that wanted to have 2 or 3 million babies, right? So that's more than enough oocytes, right, to make sure that the species moves on just fine, okay? And then they actually start to die. So by the time you're born, you have about 50,000 eggs left for ovulation. But again, I still don't know anybody that even wants to have 50,000 babies, right? So that's still plenty. All right, so once a month, an egg will be ovulated, right? And what cavity are we in right here? What cavity am I encircling? That's the pelvic cavity, okay? And that egg is ovulated. Ooh, maybe I have a little picture of ovulation here someplace. Oh, here is an egg being ovulated from this ovary. And this cell right here is a pretty big cell. You can almost see it with your naked eye. It is so big. Okay, but does it have cilia? Do you see any cilia? Does it have a flagellum? No cilia, no flagellum. So in terms of motility, what does that mean? It really doesn't have any kind of motility, and it would stay right around the ovary right here, except for one particular modification. All right, so remember that sperm, when they're produced in the testes, they're within a tube, and that tube just connects to more tubes, and the sperm can't go anywhere except to the urethra and then out of the body. But that egg, all right, there's no tube that is completely surrounding the ovary right here. The reproductive structure starts right at the end of this fallopian tube with the fimbria. So this is like an open-ended tube that is associated with the ovary but doesn't completely surround it, right? And that egg can float around anywhere within the pelvic cavity. And is there anything separating the pelvic cavity from the abdominal cavity? Okay, like there's a structure that separates the thoracic cavity from the abdominal cavity. What's that? The diaphragm. So there's no way for something to go from one cavity to the other. But what about between the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity right here? There's nothing, right? As a matter of fact, we call it the abdominal pelvic cavity, and sometimes we call that the peritoneal cavity, right? It's really just one big cavity. Okay, so that egg actually can go anywhere in the abdominal cavity as well. But under most circumstances, right, these fimbria right here, they kind of look like fingers or feathery projections from the fallopian tube, and they're sweeping over the ovary all the time. So they're moving, right? They're sweeping over the ovary all the time. Plus the epithelium that lines both the fallopian tube right here and the fimbria is a ciliated epithelium, which means what? That's for motility. And these cilia are sweeping down toward the uterus all the time. All right, so it produces a little bit of flow through the fallopian tube into the uterus. So during ovulation, that egg kind of gets trapped with the flow. It goes with the flow into the fallopian tube and eventually makes its way to the uterus. But unless it gets bumps into a sperm, then of course it can be fertilized. And fertilization usually takes place in a fallopian tube. All right, but nonetheless, that egg moves as a result of that ciliated action right there. All right, so that's an important function of the epithelium as well as the structure of this opening of the fallopian tube. So the fallopian tube has a little narrowing right here that we call the infundibulum. There's a little bit of a bulge right here that we call the ampulla. And then here's the infundibulum, which connects to the fimbriated edge right here. And as a matter of fact, if you look at this fallopian tube, let's look at it on this view right here, and this coronal section of a fallopian tube, it should remind you of a musical instrument. Okay, not by the sound that it makes, but just by its shape. What kind of musical instrument does it kind of remind you of? Maybe around this time of year, you see these kinds of instruments. Okay, it should remind you of a trumpet that's not all coiled up, just a long trumpet. Okay, and sometimes the fallopian tube is actually called that. It's called a salpinx, and a salpinx means trumpet. So here you see salpinx labeling this part of the broad ligament, the mesosalpinx right here. All right, so sometimes the fallopian tube is referred to a salpinx, and every once in a while we have to image what the what the fallopian tube really looks like, and maybe what the inner the diameter of the uterus looks like, because sometimes there are blockages within the fallopian tube, right? And that's called a hysterosalpingogram, when we actually image what the uterus looks like and the inside of the fallopian tube looks like, to make sure that it is patent, that there is a passageway for eggs to move from the ovary all the way through the uterine or fallopian tube. All right, so salpinx just means a trumpet, because it reminded somebody of a trumpet at some point in time. All right, now these are relatively delicate structures. There's not a lot of smooth muscle in the fallopian tube like the uterus right here. And the ciliated lining is a very delicate lining, and it can be damaged by any kind of infection of the reproductive tract, right? Any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease. And it might cause scarring of the fimbria. It might degrade the ciliated lining of the fallopian tube. Now, that might not be a structural scar, but that's what we would call a functional scar, because now the fallopian tube isn't creating that flow for that egg to travel down to the uterus. Right, so that's still a functional scar. And that could actually pose some very dire circumstances to an individual. All right, so let's just say that the cilia aren't working, but there are still ways for sperm to swim up the fallopian tube. What's going to happen when that sperm bumps into an egg? Maybe it's in the pelvic cavity, or maybe it's up in the abdominal cavity, and indeed sperm, right, can leave the fallopian tube and swim anywhere they want to in the abdominal pelvic cavity, right? Fertilization can take place in the abdominal cavity, and then implantation of that embryo will happen in mesentery or on the lining of the fallopian tube or uterus or any of the digestive organs. And what do we call that circumstance? That's an ectopic pregnancy. Ectopic just means other than normal site. Where should implantation take place? In the uterus right here, because the uterus has these big, powerful muscles that can hold the developing embryo and fetus throughout the whole gestational term, but that's not true of the mesentery. So what usually happens, or what does happen, is as the fetus develops or embryo develops, it gets so heavy, it rips away from the placenta that's developing, and it causes a massive hemorrhage, right? And that massive hemorrhage, I don't know if anybody has ever survived that particular circumstance, right? So usually it's fatal and very quickly fatal. So ectopic pregnancies are what? Very, very dangerous. And they should be diagnosed early on. And who's at high risk for having an ectopic pregnancy? Anybody has a history of pelvic inflammatory disease, whether it's a sexually transmitted disease or not. Maybe somebody had an IUD, an intrauterine device, implanted in the uterus for contraception, and sometimes that causes an infection of the reproductive tract, okay? And then unfortunately, then that person is at a high risk for ectopic pregnancy as well, okay? But it's pretty easy to track, right? It's easy to see if a woman's life is in danger, as long as they seek medical attention or have good prenatal care, right? Then you don't ever have to worry about losing your life. Right? But if you have a friend that you know that is just pregnant and they have abdominal pain, you probably have to give them a lot of support, or pelvic pain, to find out maybe if it is an ectopic pregnancy. Because why? It's a very dangerous circumstance. And most women I know that are pregnant, right, would kind of like to ignore the signs and symptoms that they're losing their pregnancy, right? And it puts them at very high risk of actually hemorrhaging to death. So if you know anybody, just tell them, make sure you get to the emergency room and get it diagnosed. It's not worth losing your life over to maintain a pregnancy that can't go to term anyway, right? So make sure you help them out with that regard. All right, so if you're at high risk for an ectopic pregnancy, it can just be followed on a daily basis by looking at hormone levels, like the human chorionic gonadotropin hormone, which is what is measured in a pregnancy test. And those levels should rise every particular day, not start to decline. And if it starts to decline, then, of course, that pregnancy is terminating, and you should remove that that embryo from your body before it causes a massive hemorrhage. Okay, so imaging studies will find where it's actually located. If it's in the uterus, that's not such a big deal. Then normally that will take care of itself. Okay, so that's something about the structures right here and the lining, how important they are to maintain so that they do not scar up. All right, some other structures of the female reproductive tract. We see the uterus right here, and the uterus has three main layers associated with it. You've got the perimetrium, which is on the outside of the uterus, and then the big thick muscle layer right here, the myometrium, and then the lining, which we call the endometrium. And there's a couple different layers within each of these different layers that you don't have to know about, but if you just know those three, that's good. And the endometrium is the layer that's lost once a month during the menstrual cycle. All right, it hypertrophies, it proliferates, it grows, and so that it can support implantation. All right, and then after ovulation, if implantation does not take place, then the endometrium then is sloughed off with a little mild hemorrhage out through the cervical canal. Sometimes we call this the birth canal or part of the birth canal, and those cells are lost to the outside world. But every once in a while, some of those endometrial cells can actually make their way up through the fallopian tube and find themselves in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. And sometimes they don't completely regress and die when they move away from the uterus right here. And they can basically implant into mesentery or to the surface of the uterus or the surface of the fallopian tube. And just like the normal endometrium inside the uterus, they will proliferate and grow during the menstrual cycle, the next menstrual cycle, and then regress, right, and then grow once again during the next menstrual cycle, and then regress, all right, and so they can form like little tumors, right, they don't metastasize, they don't grow into other organs of your body, but they can at least become little benign tumors anywhere in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity, and that produces a lot of irritation in those areas. And that's what we call endometriosis. It usually goes away after menopause. Okay, but in some women, they need treatment, but it's really hard to treat because that endometriosis is very diffuse and it's really impossible to remove all of those cells surgically. All right, the inferior part of the uterus right here, and probably the strongest part, this is the cervix. Right, it forms kind of like a dome on the inferior end of the uterus. And this ring that forms around the cervix, that's what we call the fornix. So just on cross-section, whether it's a sagittal section or a coronal section, we can see the anterior fornix and the posterior fornix. And then on a coronal view, you can see the right and left fornices. But remember, it's really what? It's really a circle around the dome of the cervix. The entrance from the vagina into the cervical canal, we call that the external os. The entrance into the cervical canal from the uterus, we call that the internal os. All right, and then here we have the vagina, which also acts partly as what? The birth canal, but that also accepts the penis for deposition of sperm, right, for fertilization to take place. All right, then over here we have the urinary bladder and the urethra. And what can you tell me? Contrast this with the male reproductive tract. Here we have the urethra, and does it ever connect up with a fallopian tube? Does it ever connect to a uterus? Does it ever connect to a vagina? No, it's always completely separate, right? So the female reproductive tract never merges with the urinary tract within the pelvic cavity, like in the male. Okay. And then over here, we've got a counterpart or analog to the scrotum, and these are the labia. All right, so here it forms two different layers. So there is a vestibule, so there's a little like room right here that has the vaginal orifice, the urethral orifice, right, and the clitoris. And these organs are protected by these labia, which is really what? Just lips, right? So here is the minor labium, and then here is the labium majorum right here. And that just protects the reproductive structures from infection primarily. And then here we have something that is the analog of the penis. And this is erectile tissue. That's the clitoris in the female. All right, so it originates from the same kind of tissue that the male penis originates from. Okay, I think that's pretty good for this particular slide. Let's take a look at this diagram right here. So here we have a coronal view, right, of the female reproductive structure. And, of course, we can see the vagina very nicely and the cervix, right, and the internal, external os, the lateral fornices very nicely. And we can even see the three layers of the uterus, the perimetrium, myometrium, and endometrium right here. You guys had to know that in lab. And then we see all the particular structures of the fallopian tube, like the isthmus and this little bulge right here we call the ampule and the infundibulum, and then the fimbria. All right, remember the job of these fimbria is to help capture that egg when it's ovulated, and it's got that ciliated lining so that that egg makes its way down through the fallopian tube. All right, so here is the body of the uterus, and just like the stomach, there's a fundus right here, so that's just the top of the uterus, but it doesn't have the same function as the stomach does. What else? Ligaments that hold all these structures together. There is a big, broad ligament that attaches, all right, to the uterus and the fallopian tubes and the ovary, so it's a big broad, flat ligament. And within that, we see the ovarian ligament, which is more circular, right, which attaches to the ovary and the uterus. It holds the ovary in place. And then there's a round ligament as well that holds the uterus in place. So it's not broad, but it's more round. It's structurally stronger. And, okay, I guess that's all I want to say about this particular diagram. But the cervix right here, all right, sometimes can become cancerous. All right, and we see that in a reproductive structure. So one reasonable question might be, is cancer a sexually transmitted disease? Can cancer be transmitted by intimate sexual contact? Okay. And a lot of people are saying yes. You know, 5 years ago, everybody would say no. And it's really a shame because in the United States, there's probably about 7,000 women that die of cervical cancer every year. Okay? And that's really a shame because it doesn't ever have to happen. Right? And it is, for most cases, the reason why cervical cancer develops is due to an infection. It's called human papillomavirus. So it's a virus, and there are multiple forms of this virus. There's over 100 that have been isolated to date, and four strains of this virus have been shown to cause dysplastic changes or changes in the cytology of the cells of the cervix. And if left untreated over a long period of time, like maybe 10 or 20 years, then those cells turn into cancer, and then they can break away from the cervix and move into bone or liver and brain and start to grow there. We call that process metastasis, right? And then that eventually kills the individual. So it's very easy to protect yourself from that particular disease by getting a yearly pap smear. Okay, so they sample some of the cells of the cervix right here and look at their morphology, their structure, to see what they look like. And if it's abnormal, right, then we can tell that those cells eventually will turn into cancer, and so then they're killed with a very simple cryoablation technique. So when I say cryoablation, what do I mean? They're frozen, right? Cryogenics is a way of freezing with liquid nitrogen. It kills the cells, and then that cancer is destroyed before it ever develops. Right? So that's kind of an easy, I say it's easy for me, right? It's easy for me to say, but it's actually a fairly easy procedure as well. All right, and since an individual has maybe a decade to get that diagnosis, it's really sad that cervical cancer ever really develops in an individual. Plus, there is a vaccine that people can take now to protect themselves from human papillomavirus. That's called Gardasil, and that's the female has to take that. Males don't take it because human papillomavirus, as far as we know, doesn't cause any problems in the male reproductive tract, and males are completely asymptomatic. So males don't know if they're carrying the virus or not. Okay? So it's easily treated, it's easily observed, and you have a long time to catch it. So just try to educate yourselves on cervical cancer and that human papillomavirus. So yes, cancer is a sexually transmitted disease, right? Okay. It might have some consequences in the male, but we don't really know yet. Maybe it might help or promote prostate cancer, for instance. We're just really not sure at this point in time. Okay, so I think that's all I want to say today about the female reproductive system, so that next time we're going to talk about some things, okay, comparing the ovulatory cycle with the menstrual cycle. All right, so we're going to look at some of these cycles in the female and talk about some hormones. Okay, so if you want to read over the section in your textbook covering the hormones involved, all right, there's some hormones from the ovary, there's some hormones from the pituitary, so if you're a little familiar with those, that will help you pick up information during lecture next time. So why is this system so complicated? Why is it so different between males and females? Just to make sure that we're all different.
Probably.
I'd have to look at all my folders. So what day are you? Monday or Wednesday? You're Monday. So you got it. So you're in the afternoon?
No, in the morning.
Oh, man, you're done already.
Yeah.
I got it up in lab. You want to stop up in lab and just check?
Yeah.
Okay.